Session number 340900 real 4.
So we're going to talk about the bunkers, the posts themselves, really. And if you could just talk a bit about the first of all the bunkers where you actually worked before you went to the Truro Control Centre, and identify which ones they were, and then perhaps we can talk about a little bit about the routine and what you did on a regular basis in manning those posts. That's okay.
Well, I started off in the Farnsfield Juliet 2. I'll call it bunker, but underground post. And that was a semi-underground post, a mound of earth over it, about 3 feet high, made out of concrete with a protective factor of 1,000, which means that if there was 1,000 rad on top, you would only get one down below. Quite small. 3 or 4 metres by 2.5 metres and about 7 feet high. A small room which held a toilet and equipment. Access was by a ladder about 12 feet deep, and there was a small sump to gather any water that might come into the post and a pump. And on the surface, all you could see were two turrets, concrete turrets. One was a ventilation turret, and the other one was a ventilation turret plus an access turret. The access hole is only about 2 foot 6 by 3 feet. A steel door on top with a counterweight, so that you, when you open it, it opened relatively easily. And on top, apart from the two turrets, was we call it a mushroom head, about 4 inches, 5 inches diameter, which held the ground zero indicator. This was the device which recorded the bearing, elevation and spot size of a nuclear weapon should it go off in the vicinity. The other item on top that you could see was the blast pipe. That stuck out of the ground about 5 inches and had a cap on it. When you rigged the post up for operations, you unscrewed the cap and put a bomb power pressure baffle on it. That was to allow the peak overpressure of a nuclear weapon to go into the baffle down a pipe and record on a bomb power indicator in the underground post. The other item on top was a probe pipe. This was the fixed survey meter, a pipe simply about 5 inches in diameter, 4 or 5 inches in diameter, stuck out of the ground about 2 feet. Normally that would have a steel plate on it, a locked steel plate. But when the post was set up for operations, you would take that off, and on top you would put a plastic dome cover. This plastic dome cover was about 2 feet high and about 4 or 5 inches diameter, and that was screwed onto the steel pipe. It was plastic because it had no shielding qualities whatsoever. And of course, when you went underground, you would feed up the fixed survey meter pipe a rod, and on top of that rod was an ionisation chamber or Geiger counter. And in its normal resting position, the Geiger counter would be at the level of the plastic dome cover, so that had there been radiation around the post, the ionisation chamber would have picked it up with no shielding qualities whatsoever, so it would be a true reading on the fixed survey meter down below. The other thing which some posts had was a radio connecting plate. Towards the last 10 years of the Corps' life, the powers that be decided that too many posts might be knocked out in forms of telephonic communication in a nuclear attack, and they decided to give one post in 4 or one post in 5 a radio. And they were called master posts. The idea being that the master posts could gather information from whatever post in their cluster, and this might have been 3, 4 or 5, they would gather the post locally, the information locally, and then transmit that information by radio if necessary. The range of the radio was about 120 miles, so for example, if Varian Post had a radio, they could have actually transmitted the information to Exeter. Verium Post was not a radio post. There were radio posts around. St Cullum was a radio post, and I'm not sure whether Mavagishi was. Verium Post wasn't, although it's actually rigged up to look like one. We've salvaged radio equipment from other posts, and we've equipped Verium Bunker to make it look as if it was a master post. Underground, there were two bunks, and a table on which we put equipment. There was the bomb power indicator dial. There was the fixed survey meter rod, which was up the pipe. A cable would have led down to an indicator unit, which was set in the desk. Also on the desk would be decimeters, in case we had to go on mobile monitoring missions, and also a radiac meter, which was used to take readings outside if we had to walk some distance from the post. Because the main one, the fixed survey meter, was fixed, and that was fixed in the post. So we've got facilities for going outside on radiological surveys. The other things in the post, of course, was a big battery. The battery provided light. There was no electric mains to the post. The post would have had water containers, food boxes in an emergency. The other thing that the posts have was cooking facilities, Tommy cookers, and things to cook food in. Cooking was done at the bottom of the hatch, and with the hatch cover open. The other thing which the post had was a petrol electric set. This was to charge up the battery. The battery would last quite a long time, but if the battery was running down, then of course the idea was to take the petrol electric set up top, connect it to the battery with wires, start it up, and recharge the batteries for a while.
So that's like a generator petrol electric set.
Right. We call it a petrol electric set, but it's a generator, in other words.
Right.
This was always done outside on the post surface, and so that there was petrol. Would you believe the post people had to buy petrol in cans? We were given a special can, and that was buried in a secret hole on the post top. Obviously, they didn't want people to pinch that petrol, so it was hidden, but it was like an underground hole, as it were, which you could go and get the petrol out and load the fill the petrol electric generator and charge the battery up.
Does that secret hole still exist today at
Marion? There is a hole, actually, but whether that was the one that was used to bury the petrol, I don't know. I would have to ask the local people. I suspect not, but there are holes around in other posts that they built specially to hold that petrol. Going back to the radio, clearly there were two elements to the radio. One was a radio set underground. Cables would have gone from the radio set underground to the aerial. The aerial was set up on a special bracket on the ventilation turret. That's the one opposite to the access turret. The aerial in its contracted form was about 10 feet high. And it was pneumatic. It had guide ropes on it, and the idea was that you would put up the aerial in its retracted position. You would connect up the pneumatic pipes, and then you had the capability of pumping it up from underground. So, had suddenly, following a nuclear attack, you lost telephonic communication, from underground, i.e. a protected position, you could actually pump up the aerial and immediately establish radio contact with the parent control, rather than have to go out and do it, because there was a possibility that the ground would have been covered with radioactive fallout, and of course no use you going out in those conditions. Just going back underground again, another set of equipment which you had were individual decimeters and a charging unit. Individual decimeters were pen-like, quite small, and they're issued to each observer, and each observer would have worn a decimeter on his uniform. All the decimeters would register zero at the start of a war or at the start of a training exercise. And if you were sent out into a radiological situation and indeed did absorb some radiation, those individual decimeters would record it. And of course, the observer, if he was out in a radiological situation, would be keeping an eye on the dose that he received. And the emergency wartime dose was 70 rads. And if you actually even approached that, you would be withdrawn from whatever surface job you were doing and told to get down into the post. Whenever you did absorb any radiation, whatever the reading, when you came back, whether it was 5 or 10, it would be noted in a log, and the decimeter would be put back to zero, again using a charging unit. We call it a charging unit because all it did was to charge the decimeter with electricity. And as the decimeter was charged with electricity, the hairline on the scale would move towards zero. Radiation caused an electrical discharge. So the longer you were in a radiological situation, the more discharge that would take place, or the more intense the radiation was, the more the discharge would take place, and therefore the more the hairline would move up the scale. So it's quite a little simple piece of kit, and that was carried by all observers at all times who were on duty at the post.
Did you wear them underground as well?
Yeah.
So
it would be kept in the tunic pocket,
right?
So that it was yours. It was a personal protective device. The other thing which we had in the post was a radiac survey meter. This was a portable Geiger counter, I'll call it, and that was there in case we were asked to go on a mobile monitoring expedition. Now, this is probably one of the items, one of the subjects which causes the most hilarity to visitors to Verium Bunker, because the scientists at the control very often were interested in where a fallout front might be. A fallout plume is very much like a plume of rain falling on the ground. And in other words, you can go along and it's perfectly dry, and suddenly you reach a point where it's wet. And that is the edge of the rain cloud or the rain. And it's the same with fallout. You would go along with no radiation at all until you actually entered the fallout. And at that point, you would call it the fallout front. The scientists were keen to pick up the edge of a fallout front in certain cases, and they always told us it was possible or probable that a post might be asked to go on a mobile monitoring expedition. Now, this meant selecting one observer to go out of the post and either walk or bike or get in his car, if his car was parked at the post, and go down the road, probably heading in a direction that the scientist told him to go, until he found the fallout front. Now, clearly, he would take the radiac survey meter with him, and just supposing he was walking, he would walk along with this meter in his hand. Perfectly all right, no radiation showing, and then maybe 2 miles down the road, it would begin to kick up. Now, clearly, on the edge of the fallout plume, it would only kick up slightly. If he was silly enough to walk in right into the fallout plume, half a mile, say, it would go up more and more and more. But an observer with any sense would actually record the geographic position where the meter had kicked up, make a note of the reading and that position, go back quickly to the post, and that would be reported to the scientists in the console who were trying to sort out where the actual fallout plumes were, and more importantly, where the fallout was going to go in the future. They called it a mobile monitoring expedition. And, of course, most visitors just cannot visualise the situation where a nuclear weapon's gone off, 3 observers are down the safe post, they are comfortable, they are safe from radiation. And then suddenly, the person in charge of the post has to say to one person, "Oh, by the way, Bill, can you walk down the lane to find this fallout from?" Whether we would have done it has been debated. I would like to think we would, We were a uniformed, disciplined crowd of people, and I would have liked to think that we would have had enough about us to actually do it. We had got a certain amount of protection because we'd got a decimeter, we'd got the radar survey meter, which would tell us if we were in a radiological situation. What it wouldn't tell us, of course, is that if we'd got, say we went 3 miles down the road and picked up a fallout front, if there was another front coming in which actually covered the post, then of course we may run into a second fallout front, which might have caused problems. So it's all a bit iffy, and that actually causes a certain amount of hilarity when I tell people that at Verian Post.
Were you given any protection?
No. That's another favourite question. Were we issued with MBC suits? The answer is no. We weren't issued with MBC suits. We weren't issued with gas masks in any way. which people are surprised at, but we weren't. And we just had overalls, either over our uniforms or instead of our uniforms. So no, we never had any NCB seats at all. So that was the setup in a post. Obviously, we never had a nuclear war for real. So we used to exercise and play war games. And a typical exercise would be that three people would go to the post. They would set up all the operational equipment. Everything would be live as if it was for real. The telephone lines would be through. They'd have food there. They'd have water. The battery would be charged up. They'd put fresh sets of papers in the GZI, because the GZI contained four cassettes which had photographic paper in to record the position of nuclear weapons. They will be fresh, as it were, and they will be set up. All the instruments will be set up. The battery will be charged, and then the observers would wait. And this is what it would be like for real. No one ever knew if a bomb would fall on Cornwall. No one ever knew where a bomb would fall. You would just wait and watch. If you were there for more than 8 hours, a decision would be made to change shifts. So three observers would go off and three new observers would come on. And it would rotate like that, either for the duration of the exercise, or if it was for real, you would rotate like that until a nuclear attack occurred, or the all clear was sounded and everybody packed up and went home. So that was the idea. Just supposing a nuclear attack occurred, the first indication to the observers underground would be the bomb power indicator showing a reading. And it would simply be on 0 1 minute and flirt up to a reading the next. Originally, the dial showed pressures in pounds per square inch, but latterly we went metric and it was in kilopascals. So whatever it was, we would report it as 10 or 20 or 15, and that would be reported to the group headquarters. Following every reading on the bomb power indicator, and the observers underground, depending on the closeness of the bomb, may or may not have heard a bang. It's debatable whether they would have done underground like that. But they may have done. Following any pressure, the observers would wait 10 seconds and then press a button on the bomb power indicator to zeroise it. So having made a note of the pressure and the time, they would zeroise the bomb power indicator. That was done in case there were subsequent bursts. And if the meter kicked up again, a note would be made of the time and the pressure, and it would be zeroised again and again and again. 60 seconds after each pressure, and we'll talk about the first pressure now, 60 seconds after the pressure was shown and reported, the chief in charge of the operational crew would select one person, and there's been quite a debate on this, and he would say to him, "Would you go up top, climb the ladder, take a light-proof satchel with new GZI papers in it, go up top, undo the hatch, climb out, close the hatch again, take the top off the GZI, take the old papers out, or the exposed papers, put them in the inner pocket of the satchel, and take the new papers out of the outer pocket, and reload the GZI, put the top back on again, screw it all down, undo the post, climb down it, close the hatch cover again, go down the post with the exposed papers. These would be given to another observer, and he would study them for any marks of a nuclear weapon that might be on them. Now, one assumes if the bomb power indicator had shown a reading, then there would also be a mark on the GZI papers. These marks, or this mark, would be assessed in terms of bearing, elevation, and the size of the spot. Now, by the size of the spot, I mean the spot made by a nuclear weapon going off was a somewhat a blurred circle or semicircle. An important aspect was whether or not the spot touched the ground. With the GZI being a form of pinhole camera, it recorded the ground as a light area and the sky as a darker area. It would also record the passage of the sun. So if it was a clear day, the passage of the sun would be etched on the exposed GZI papers. In addition to the sun, of course, there would be the mark of a nuclear weapon. And so that would be assessed. If it was circular, the person assessing it would determine the width of the spot in terms of degrees, 5 degrees, 10 degrees. Obviously, the bigger the spot, the nearer the explosion had been to the post, or the bigger the weapon was. It was very important to determine whether the spot touched the ground or not, because if the spot touched the ground, it would mean the weapon was a ground burst weapon. And when a nuclear explosion occurs on the ground, it vaporizes all the ground material, buildings, trees, debris, rock from the crater, and all this material goes up in the mushroom cloud. It's charged with radiation, and it gradually falls to Earth again in the form of radioactive dust. And this is typical of a wartime burst. It's actually typical of things like Chernobyl, where radioactive dust fell to Earth again, many, many hundreds of miles from the source of I'll call it detonation. That's what would happen with a ground burst weapon. As I say, the bearings, the elevations and spot size, and whether the weapon touched the ground or not, would all be reported to the group control. Now, clearly, every other post in the group or the country would be doing the same sort of thing. In the controls, they had a team called the triangulation team, and these teams would receive all the bearings, all the elevations, all the pressures and the times, and it was their job to assess and calculate where every bomb had gone off. It was their job to calculate exactly where, exactly the height, and exactly the power and the time that the bomb had gone off, because different posts would report different times of detonation, because all they were reporting was the time that the pressure wave went to their post, got to their post. So it was the triangulations team job to assess all those details. Once they'd done that, all those details would be passed on to other controls, the services, local authorities, government and so on. Because the one big thing government wanted to know was, where the heck had the bomb gone off? And I know that sounds silly, because if a nuclear weapon went off over Plymouth, people could say, oh, there's a bomb gone off over Plymouth. But when you're forecasting where fallout's going to go, you want a much more exact ground zero than, oh, it's gone off over Plymouth. And the triangulation teams could probably calculate the position of ground zero, plus or minus quarter of a mile, if not less. So that was the reason why all this work was done. The range of the bomb power indicator was about 25 miles and at each post, and the range of the GZI was about 30 miles. So there was a considerable overlap. Posts were about 15 miles apart, and it was thought that unless the weapon was very small, that the weapon would actually make a mark and give readings to several posts at the same time, roughly the same time. And that's why the triangulation team may get 3, 4, 5 bearings onto one detonation or one bomb.
So it's on the basis, really, that the more information that they get, they got, the more accurately they could
Pinpoint. And they would average the different... Because every set of data you use would give you a different power, a different time, and a different height. And you would do that for probably 5 different sets of readings and then average it. They've got a system called a cocked hat system for triangulation, and but it was an average at the end of the day.
With the ground zero indicator, with those papers, did they have to be developed in the post?
No,
they didn't.
No, they were photographic papers, bromide papers, I think they call them, which actually darkened on exposure to light. And if you went out with a paper into the sunlight and just stood there, holding it up to the sun, it would just go darker and darker and darker and darker until it was nearly black. But that would take several minutes. So, in fact, one reason why the unexposed papers, because the unexposed papers were white, but the exposed papers were dark brown, very dark brown. It follows that all the marks on it, like the sun or a nuclear weapon, was dark brown, or to varying degrees dark brown. The graticule, because that was etched on by a cassette, which actually stopped the light getting to where the graticule was in white. So those papers would actually darken and darken and darken, and I say that's why they were kept in a light-proof satchel. But after they'd reported the details of all the details to do with the bomb, they would sit back and wait, because the post people, apart from knowing what bearing a bomb had gone off from them, wouldn't have an exact idea of how far it was away from them, and they would have no clear way of knowing if they were going to get fallout. So they would sit back, the fixed survey meter would be on, assuming there was no other bombs in the vicinity, they would sit back and wait, and they would simply look at a dial, an LED display, all the time. If that went up, or if fallout arrived at the post, that would go up, and it would go up modestly slowly. By slowly, I mean 0.1, 0.5, 1, 5, 10, 20, probably over the space of 20 minutes, depending again on the intensity of the radiation coming from the bomb. They would report these readings every 5 minutes to the group control. And they would continue doing that for the duration of the exercise or for the duration of the war. And we're talking about observer corps posts were designed to hold 3 observers for 3 weeks in the aftermath of a nuclear war. So one assumes that these observers, if they had radiation readings, would go on reporting it for 3 weeks. They would do that because radiation actually decays. So levels of intensity would get less and less and less. There is a decay rule called the 7/10 rule. As the time is increased by a factor of 7, the dose rate is divided by a factor of 10. So if 7 hours after burst, it's 1,000, 7 times 7, which is 49 hours, the radiation level would be 100. And 2 days times 7, which is a fortnight, it will be 10. So that's what's called the 7/10 rule. It's not an exact rule, but it's a good rule of thumb. this is why the scientists determined that the observer corps crew would be on the post in a war situation for at least 3 weeks. After that comes the survival role. Well, the observer corps had nothing to do with the survival role as such. That was the role of the local authority and the police and the fire service, etc., etc.